in a world full of straight people. Aren't you glad there's WOW Presents Plus, the number one place in the world to see Drag Race? RuPaul's Drag Race, say the best drag queen wins. And so much more. Subscribe to WOW Presents Plus. Still only $4.99. Subscribe today as streamed on TV.
Start your engines and join me in the new mobile game, RuPaul's Drag Race Superstar. May the best superstar win. Available now.
Well, Dave, we're here with Leo Mejil, an artist, filmmaker, and actor, and also the first trans actor to ever win the Sundance Special Jury Award for acting for their leading role in the award-winning film Mutt, which is streaming on Netflix.
It's on Netflix now.
We just watched it this morning.
Yep.
A bright and early 8 a.m., you know, devastating indie drama. Nothing like it. Leo, thanks for being here. And obviously, we'll talk a ton about the film, but this is our first recording of the new year. So how were your holidays?
Happy New Year, you guys.
Happy New Year, Leo.
My holidays were pretty good. I view the winter solstice as my new year. And so that was on December 21st. Because as we know, that's when it's equal part day and night. And then the sunrise on the following day after the solstice is sort of the first sunrise as the light begins to return, at least in the Northern Hemisphere. So I started kind of my shedding, reflecting, releasing, and intention setting around then. And so I'm in like week three of this like metamorphosis chapter. And I'm feeling really good. And today is actually a really, I'm so into astrology. So just be prepared. I'm going to be invoking that throughout this conversation.
We're prepared.
Okay, cool.
Oh, very much so.
Today is a new moon in Capricorn, and it's a really, really lucky positive day astrologically. And it kind of, because it's the first new moon of the year, sort of starts the new year in a sort of cosmic energetic way. And so it's really nice to be talking to you guys during this auspicious day. And also this interview I did for Interview Magazine came out today. And I'm like,
this awesome.
Is all a great sign.
Oh, what fun. A day. Who interviewed you?
Today?
Maya Hawke, who is
awesome.
Yeah.
Oh my God.
So smart and grounded and brilliant. She's got this energy of like a Buddhist almost. Mm-hmm. Like she just is able to channel really deep, sort of simple aphorisms one after the next. So it was really great to talk to her.
Wow.
Yeah, I'm a fan. Man. You know, she was part of that ridiculous Nepo baby expose. It's like so dumb to me, that entire storyline, that it was like, wait, so you're saying that Hollywood isn't entirely fair and democratic? So, but anyway, she to me is just kind of like, I don't care that her parents are famous because she's so talented.
Totally. And also she has the coolest famous parents. Like yes. It's not even just, you know, celebrities that have made her life really awkward and difficult and bizarre. It's Ethan Hawke and Uma Thurman, who are the most sort of like prestigious artists. They're not celebrities in that we care what restaurant they're going to. They're celebrities in that we are obsessed with everything they put out into the world. And so I feel like having parents who are true artists and are able to introduce her to the coolest things as she grows up. Like, I don't know. I feel like, of course, she ended up so and talented and sweet.
Yeah. That's a Nepo baby success story.
Exactly.
So, I mean, can you talk us through some of your intentions that you have set for 2024? What's the energy?
Yeah. I mean, so many things. One thing that's been coming up is that I have a very sophisticated inner critic who is able to take any little thing that happens and be like, you know what, actually this is what you should have said and done and thought and been like. And I call him Larry because this is his vibe. He's got this like sort of Larry energy.
It's you, Larry.
And yeah, and I think that something I'm in a practice of doing now that I'm sort of in this next stage of my career is letting go of control and trying to engage with Larry's sophisticated intellectualism in the other direction. So when I start to have this thought pattern of like, oh, this is almost good, but it's not quite there, I'm like, Larry, what if we employ your tools and think of this as the exact perfect, most beautiful, surprising way it could have turned out that you don't even totally know about? Like, what, let's collaborate to create that story for a moment. And it's literally as simple as that in my head. Like, I'm having to hold on, have a conversation with him, and then redirect. And I think that's part of just like a larger arc that I'm experiencing right now, which is, you know, when you are having success as an artist, a lot of what you're doing is not, a lot of how you're received is not in your control. Like the work that you're doing is sort of, let's say with Mutt, it's like my work was showing up on set and sort of like revealing myself, trying to understand the truth of the story and the character. And then the way that it's received or the way that it affects people or people talk about it, or even when I look at it on screen, it's like, that's not my job anymore. You know what I mean? Like, I sort of have to let that go. And I don't know, the trans experience is not a monolith, but for me, so much of my life coming into my gender identity was wanting to have control over how people viewed me a little bit more, like have more of a say, because there was this chasm between the way that I felt I was and the way people were receiving me. And so it required me to sort of get on top of myself a little bit to connect with people on my terms. And I actually, now that I'm feeling really good in my body, feeling really sort of at home in myself, the ask is to release that and to sort of step away and not be so on top of it, and just sort of let the connections or let the work or let the image or the words do what they're going to do, you know?
Yeah. That's a lot though. How, I mean,
it's a lot.
It's a lot to unwind, you know?
Yes. Tell me about it.
Yeah. It feels like the more sort of like basic approach to handling our inner Larrys would be to try to silence him, override him, ignore him. And what you're talking about is sounds so much healthier. Like you're actually engaging in recognizing what his role is, you know, and being in conversation with him. I don't know. I don't have a question. I'm just really struck totally by that. I'm like, oh God, I have a lot of work to do with my inner Larry in a good way.
Totally. I mean, this sort of way of approaching the different parts of ourselves, I think is called internal family systems.
Yes.
It's a modality of healing work that, you know, many people have encountered in therapy and other places, but acknowledging that we have all these different parts of ourselves that genuinely want the best for us. They have good intentions to protect us, to allow us to thrive, to be safe. And they were formed at different moments in our lives. And so, you know, the part of me that's 7 and feels like I need to lie about eating cookies in order to be safe in my kitchen, you know, I'm using a random example, but that part of me that then sort of like just becomes a habit and becomes unconscious now as an adult, I don't need to lie about XYZ in order to be loved by my partner. In fact, honesty is what keeps me safer. It allows me to have deeper intimacy. And so that part of me, while it has a good intention, wants to be like loved and assured that Papa Leo knows what to do now, and it doesn't need to do that old behavior and come on over and like join this other party. You know, that integration process, I think, is a lot, what you said, healthier, or what I'm striving for than the silencing and the dismissal, because then I'm just ignoring something that's there or pushing it down. I don't know.
Yeah. That inner critic, that Larry, is like in a terrible and dysfunctional way trying to keep you safe.
Yeah.
You know?
Totally.
And yeah, that is a struggle as well, is to just say like, okay, I got you. You are safe. We are safe. You know, I like the idea of being in conversation and not just, you know, trying to push it down. That's
Leo, we have to ask what your signs are.
Yeah. So I'm a Gemini sun, Gemini rising, and Capricorn moon. Geminis really get a bad rap. So I want to say that my my Mercury, which is like the planet of communication and intellectualism, all those things, it's the messenger planet. I have it in Cancer, which is like a really sensitive, sensual, moon-driven sign. And so because Gemini is so prominent in my chart, Mercury is really prominent in my personality. The way I communicate is very much like a Cancer. So people think I'm a Cancer. This is all to say that you know, Geminis get a bad rap. So I'm like preemptively being defensive about it.
No, they do. They do. I think they sound dangerous.
I know. Or just unpredictable or unreliable. Yeah. But that ain't true. It's so dependent on the rest of the placements, you know?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure there's some kind of intellectual argument to be made around Geminis and like gender identity.
Yeah.
I don't know what it is, but there's something to that idea.
Yeah. It's the twins. What about you?
Yeah.
Do you know?
I'm Capricorn sun and Scorpio rising and Leo moon.
Nice.
Leo moon.
I'm Pisces, Scorpio, Pisces.
Hell yeah. Water. So
water. A lot of water. For those who don't follow the zodiac as closely, Leo, which friend are you? Are you a Chandler? God rest him. Are you?
Oh my goodness.
What a Rachel?
I am a Joey.
A Joey. That's a good thing to be.
I'm totally a Joey mixed with a Chandler. But yeah, like in my friend groups, I can be kind of, I sort of perform doofus because it's fun and playful. Yeah, I'm probably a mix between Chandler and Joey.
Okay.
It's a good mix. Solid.
It's a good mix. It's a good mix. And that's a mix that's going to have a very strong 2024. If you just look at, you know, if you look at the charts.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Leo, what have you been watching lately? Whether it be a TV binge or an end of year Oscar conversation film, what's grabbed you lately?
Well, currently I tend to watch TV for comfort and to sort of shut off my brain a little bit. I've been watching or rewatching Schitt's Creek, which is so fucking good. Like the actors in this show are giving Oscar level performances, and I call them by their character names. David and Alexis, like, they are performing siblings so well. They have the same gestures and like facial tics and all of these. I'm like, I'm so impressed this time around as I've been watching it, because I'm like not needing to dissociate currently. You know, I feel like sometimes comfort TV is like good to dissociate too, but currently I'm not feeling like I need to dissociate. So I'm really sort of engaging with it. And I'm like, this is a really, the performances are so funny and so committed and well executed. So shout out to them. And then Oscar stuff, I mean, May December was a trip.
Yes.
See it?
Yeah.
I've not yet.
Okay. There's this part where I'm not going to give it away, but Natalie Portman does a monologue. You know what I'm talking about, right, Matt?
Oh yeah. Yeah.
I want to recreate that moment, like me being Natalie Portman, being Julianne Moore, being this woman. Like, I want
so
her to be this
crazy.
Like inception.
Yeah.
Because it's so pleasurable to watch her sort of take on these vocal tics and the posture, because that's really what she's doing. Natalie Portman is such a technician. It's also very satisfying. And so you can see her doing the mouth thing. And I just sort of want to do like a parody of that. I'm like, why has no actual internet like personality person like done that yet?
Yeah, that'd be a great, what do you call it? I'm not on TikTok, but duet.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. That's not my domain. So I feel like maybe I'm just saying it so someone can hear it and do it, because we all need that. But it's a really beautiful movie. I mean, Todd Haynes is just such a I what is that movie, Far From Heaven? That was the first movie I got assigned to watch in college. And we were talking about mise-en-scene and like sort of the production design and the color. And Todd Haynes is just so good. Every shot is a painting, like 10 out of 10. Yeah. So yeah, that was one of my favorites. I saw Saltburn too. I love Jacob Elordi and Barry, but I'm just this, I don't know. I really liked Promising Young Woman. Saltburn felt a little, this is a rote. Can I just give my real opinion?
Please.
Please do, because
it felt like no one gave her notes on the script.
Yes.
Yeah. It felt like Promising Young Woman was such a home run from a script perspective, story perspective, and then execution in its like rhythm and all this stuff. And then everyone in Hollywood was like, oh my God, you're so amazing. Just whatever you want to make, we'll just make it. And she's like, yes, extravagant, full. I've always dreamed of doing a castle film. Let's do it. It's a party film. It's Project X. And they're like, yes, yes, yes. And then she gave the first draft and they were like, let's go to production. We've got Jacob on the phone. He's ready. Like, you know, that's what it felt like. Everyone was just salivating and not like awake to actually be the story and the arc and stuff. But
yeah,
I mean, they're also hot. It was really sexy.
It's a very sexy movie. Yeah.
I found it to be very sexual, but not at all sexy. I felt like it was like male homosexuality as provocation, but not, but there was no, I just couldn't have, it felt like if like Brideshead Revisited were a Lady Gaga video, it would be Saltburn, you know? And at the end of it, I was like, she didn't like any of those characters. Yeah. It wasn't fun. It wasn't sexy. It was like, it just felt empty.
Yeah. It was very empty. It was like the image of itself.
Yes.
You know?
Yeah. The music was great. I'm happy. Yeah. Always happy to see Sophie Ellis Bextor get a little bump. This is good. Murder on the Dance Floor deserves to be, it deserves the running up that hill treatment that it appears to be getting.
Yes.
Yeah. It made me angry.
Yeah. What are you guys watching? What is your relationship?
I'm sure you're going to have a better answer.
Actually, what drives you to watch something? How do you watch movies and TV? Like what role does
you asking us thoughtful questions?
Wow. That's so kind. I love this. What a way to start the year.
I mean, for me, right. You know, I'm married and it's our nightly ritual. And it's just the very sort of boring traditional thing of just like, what show are we going to commit to? So we have a thing that we can do every night. And we did The Sopranos finished that over winter break. And now we're in the middle of The Bear, which I love, have you seen The Bear at all?
I've seen many episodes, but not the full thing. It's good.
Yeah, it's great. It feels like such a queer show, even though there are no queer characters I can think of, but for some reason I can't put my finger on it, but it feels so like explicitly queer.
It's embodied. Like Jeremy Allen White, I think why everyone is having this sort of total, like their heads are exploding with him is because his lips are parted. There's saliva on them. Like he's so embodied and like open mouth and like his tongue. I mean, I'm sure at some point you guys have taken some kind of like voice lesson. Actors, we have to take like vocal training. And voice teachers have always said, okay, release your stomach, the tension in your stomach, allow your tongue to sit behind your bottom teeth and part your lips. And Jeremy Allen White, that's his resting position like all the time. And so he's got this way where you're just like looking into the depths of his like saliva filled mouth or his like pulsing veiny body, whatever it is. It's not plastic. It's really supple. And the show feels queer to me similarly. I mean, of course, AO is queer, but it feels queer because it is messy, imperfect, fleshy bodies on display. It's not the polished TV show where even though it's supposed to be gritty, everyone's hair is coiffed in this very particular way. You know, it's got this like fleshy thing. And I think a part of it is because it was homies together in Chicago season one making something sort of in real time, you know, without all of the distancing effects that 300 person crews create. So it's like really up close in an embodied way. So it feels very queer to me also.
Did you ever work in a restaurant? Because I resisted it for a long time because of like waiter PTSD.
Totally.
And that it does trigger that, but still very enjoyable.
Yeah. Yeah, I worked. It was a really iconic chapter of my life. Right after college, I worked at Buffalo Wild Wings in Times Square.
Wow.
Yeah, you did.
And you have to understand, wow. I was like on Broadway as a kid. Like Times Square has this sort of like historical nostalgic position in my life. And I don't even know that I thought it through. I just had never had a server job before and this place would hire me. And I was going to be making a couple $100 in cash every day because it's so busy. It's like a 4-story mall of a chicken wing place. It was so chaotic and so intense. And the proximity to Broadway was so weird because I was like, none of these people know. They don't know who I am. Like in my mind of like who I'm going to be because I had just gotten out of college and, you know, was both totally terrified and also probably had a larger ego than I will ever have again. But yeah, that was pretty intense. And so the bear, I mean, like people screaming and trying not to pay, and it's so chaotic. Yeah.
I'm so glad someone has finally brought up Buffalo Wild Wings. What's the menu item to get? What's the insider tip?
I do not eat any of that food. I can't. I'm allergic to gluten, and all of the chicken wings are like covered in breading. Yeah. Even the fries like have breading with them. I mean, there had like a sweet and sour wing. I'm going to just admit to you that the kitchen was in the basement of the Buffalo Wild Wings. And so as a server, you would have to walk the food up this back staircase. And when I was in that back staircase, I would like eat people's fries on my way up. Like I was, you know,
we have to expect that. We have to expect that.
Okay. I like don't talk to other servers very often. So I don't know if that's like a thing that's done or if it's like totally messed up and not hygienic, but whatever.
I mean, I'm sure it's not one of the top 10 worst hygiene violations in a Buffalo Wild Wings.
Totally. And I don't think the customers there at the Times Square Buffalo Wild Wings are so concerned with like pristine hygiene. Yeah. I don't think that's their number one priority.
Yeah. You know, it's a very strange thing. So you were in New York and now you're in LA, and that is true for all of us on this call. And so in my years in New York, I would eat anywhere. I would have a slice and a you know, a Jamaican meat patty from the dirtiest place in the East Village and not think anything of it. In Hollywood, there are places that like look clean and I'm terrified to eat there. There's just something, it's like with the cold. There's something about like dirt. When something is dirty looking in Los Angeles, it somehow hits different.
Totally. Mm-hmm. I mean, Hollywood, my mom has had a loft in Chelsea since like the 70s. It's rent controlled, 30th Street between 7th and 8th. It's like a whole, I think she actually saw Ripley Greer Studio to rent it as her loft before she saw the loft that she ended up choosing. Like all these lofts on 8th Avenue were for rent at the same time. And so she lives there. So I grew up like in the middle of like Midtown and then Times Square, like really, like you're saying, dirty, nasty shit. And just all over the place doing who knows what. When I go for a walk in Hollywood at night or downtown LA, I am feeling so disoriented and weird and sort of like cagey in this way that I never feel in New York City. And I'm like, is it because, I mean, to bring us there, is it because there is a deeper stratification and separation between wealth and poverty in LA, where it's like in New York, at the end of the day, even if you've got some sexy Soho, whatever, or Williamsburg, whatever, you probably take the subway sometimes. Like there's a kind of integration. And because there's street life, everybody's on the street. It's not just people who are houseless. Like everybody's moving around. There's like this integration that makes it feel more connected, communal. It's like of the city. The city has character. In LA, everyone's in their cars all the time. And so if you're walking on a sidewalk, sort of regardless of the neighborhood, unless you're out in the hills sort of walking by the houses, if you're on an actual sidewalk, it feels weird. And like, you're trespassing, or you're like, you know, looking around in this way, you just feel alienated. It's very bizarre.
Yes, it is very bizarre. It's very bizarre.
I wouldn't eat in the places in Hollywood. You're right.
Yeah. So I got my catalytic converter stolen, and now that it's been a couple months, my partner and I both have Priuses, and we both got them snatched in one night in our driveway, which is a whole other thing. But Ben got his fixed right away. I then traveled and I've been sort of in and out. And so now when I'm here, I don't have a car, and I will get it fixed. I need to get it fixed because I have to have a car. But in the meantime, I've just been biking everywhere. And so I've been using the metro, which I never really did before. There's a stop not far. It's like a 10-minute bike ride from here. And, you know, a couple stops, I'm over the hill and into Hollywood and whatever. So I've been biking and using the subway. And the subway, or it's not the subway, it's the metro. The metro is not commuters. You know what I mean? It's people who are living on the train, basically. And this, my stop at North Hollywood is like the last stop. So every time I get off at North Hollywood, the police are there to like get people off the train.
Wow.
And it's only kind of the houseless and relatively poor using it, and no one else. And it it really brings the like haves and have nots situation of Los Angeles into sharp detail.
And it would be as a New Yorker, I feel like I can say this from experience, it would be more comfortable, it would be safer, it would be a better vibe if there was more integration. Like if LA sort of reoriented itself from just being car highway exclusively to sort of investing in a metro, sort of in making it something that people can use. And that doesn't mean getting the houseless people off the train. It just means making it sort of more a part of LA culture. Because then the city would have this character. Right now, to me, LA, I mean, I love LA. I love living here. I feel so grateful. The weather totally changes my personality for the better.
Yeah.
But it feels like a suburb with culture. It doesn't feel like a city.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't feel the character and persona that it has, which it definitely has one, feels like an illusion, a mythology, something that sits almost like the smog that sits on top of the city. Like when I watch Mulholland Drive, I'm like, yeah, Hollywood. Yes, weird. What is happening? Whereas New York, it's like the personality like simmers on the cement in the summer, you know, like it's like sitting on the ground and you can be in it and of it. Whereas LA, I'm like, I went on a walk the other day and I saw this castle because I live in Franklin Village right near the Hollywood sign. Mm-hmm. And so if I walk up, there are these houses that are sitting at the top of the Hollywood Hills overlooking everything. And for the first time, I went a different way yesterday and I saw a massive castle on the top of a hill overlooking this. I'm like, who lives there? I can send you guys a photo later, but it's insane. It looks like Saltburn. But lives there? Is that a Scientology building or is it a celebrity who is up there in this like play pretend castle that looks like it was plopped from somewhere else, like not old? It's really weird. Anyways,
did they like host a game show in 1951 for two seasons and like make a good investment or whatever? Like Toluca Lake is all of these beautiful homes, and it's like this is somebody who like did three commercials in the 60s, and they just invested well or whatever.
Yeah,
it's a wild.
That's true.
It's a wild city we have chosen.
That supports the illusion thing, though, where it's like it's this one thing. And then look, and I don't mean to say that that person isn't smart for making that investment. Fantastic. Mm-hmm. I love, real estate is great, but it's bizarre. It doesn't feel real in the sense of I did a commercial in 1960 and then look like I invested well and here I am.
Yeah.
It's like the lottery or something,
Yeah. Yeah. I want, there's something we need to get into, but just because you did ask, and I do want to just put this on the table. We are currently rewatching Dynasty.
Wow.
And it's great.
It's like a full rewatch from episode one.
Well, it's on Pluto. There's a channel that's just Dynasty on Pluto TV. Wow. And so we kind of dip in. We're watching non-consecutive. Like, you know, tonight it could be something from season five. They could be in Moldavia, right? The royal wedding where there was a mass shooting could have maybe just happened. Mm-hmm. But then the next day, it's like it's started over and now we're at season one again. But basically, we'll just sort of watch two or three episodes in a row because it is such good, effective television. Like, Joan Collins is...
What is Dynasty?
An international treasure. It was an Aaron Spelling nighttime soap in the 1980s. And it was John Forsythe, Linda Evans. This is so, I mean, if we can introduce you to Dynasty.
Hell yeah.
then I feel like I'm already off to a successful 2024. But it was the 80s nighttime soap. It was in the wake of Dallas, right? Yeah. Which was sort of, you know, it was oil people in Texas and whatever. This is also oil people, I think, but it was Denver, and there was a designer by the name of Nolan Miller who like created the big shoulder pads look.
Oh yeah.
So all of the women are turned out in like crazy wigs and like linebacker shoulders, and they're constantly getting into like physical fights that where it's you can tell they've been replaced by stuntmen. Oh yeah, they're constant. Everyone's always fighting with one another. There's always a good slap. It often turns into like a fight and they tumble down some stairs. It's just pure 80s like excess and money and you know, ridiculous storylines, and Joan Collins just eating. It's fantastic. It's fantastic. They remade it a few years ago with Grant Cho as the sort of patriarch of the family, and it's, you know, whatever. It didn't speak to our time the way that the original Dynasty spoke to the 1980s, but I can't recommend it highly enough.
That's
a great rec.
It's I mean, you'll dig it. And Pluto TV has a lot of little treasures like that. But what do you mean you were on Broadway when you were a kid?
Oh yeah. I saw, when I was in fifth grade, I saw an ad in the school newspaper for an audition for the show, The Miracle Worker, with Hilary Swank as the miracle worker in question. And it was for the understudy of Helen Keller. And I auditioned and I got it. And Skye McCole Bartusiak, who was a young child actress, also was playing Helen Keller. But because it was so physically demanding, we sort of switched off. And went Marianne Elliott, who's a really amazing British director. She did, what's that? Something of the Dog at Nighttime, that really fun. Mm-hmm.
Curious Case.
Assembly. Yes, Curious Case.
Yeah.
She works with Frantic Assembly a lot. She's so fantastic. So she directed it. We were in North Carolina for our previews. And then we were moving into the Music Box Theater and there was a bomb threat on Times Square. And so all the shows that had not yet opened, that were already, like, we had built the set, all the things, like, we closed. And then the stage managers of that show did Cat in Hot Tin Roof at the Music Box Theater, the next show that they did. And there was a kid part in it and they were like, you should audition. And I did. And then I got that. So Anthony Page, I think, directed that. And I was one of the no neck monsters, but the one that sort of several scenes and is like in it. I was on Broadway for like a year.
Anyone else we know from that cast of
Ashley Judd? Ashley Judd was playing Maggie.
Wow. And
Ned Beatty was Big Daddy. And Margot Martindale, who is an icon.
Oh my god.
Is she Big Mama in it? Are they Big Daddy and Big Mama, or is it just Big Daddy?
Sounds right. Because
I too was a no neck monster in St. Louis, Missouri back in like 1980. St. Louis rep. Yeah, it's fun. You don't have much to do, but it's you run through and make a bunch of noise. Who was Brick?
Jason Patrick. Yeah.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, he's like an old school actor. I feel like I haven't seen him around in a minute. But it was a really amazing experience because the woman who is the understudy for Ashley Judd is this actress, Kelly McAndrew, who works a ton in New York. And she was queer. She was a queer woman. And I became really, really close with her and sort of started to understand for the first time that I was queer. And weirdly, I saw Boys Don't Cry and had just worked with Hilary Swank. And it was like this moment that was maybe like my first memory as a young person being like, oh, what's going on with these people? Like, this is interesting and attractive to me. So that's like one of my core memories from the experience was having that feeling and not being sure what it was.
And so if we fast forward a bit, I mean, Mutt obviously feels like a game changing role for you for so many reasons, but just before it came along, what did your career look like and how were you, what was your overall outlook about the acting part of your life?
Yeah, I mean, when I was, so my mom is really supportive of everything I do. And she was the one who kind of took me to those auditions and stuff. And my dad came into my life more prominently sort of when I was 12 or so. And he was worried I was going to become a drug addicted child star. And so he was like, I want them to stop acting. And my mom was like, okay, you know, whatever. I don't know. I wasn't a part of this decision. So I stopped acting at that point. And then, you know, went to finished middle school, high school, college. And when I graduated from college, I didn't really know how to be a professional actor. And I was kind of obsessed with performance art and installation and at the time virtual reality. And I was just sort of in these other fields doing stuff. And it wasn't until like two or so years after graduating where I was like, oh, I think I'm kind of depressed. And it might be because I'm not acting. I don't have this space in which I can sort of release all of this emotional energy I have. And so this woman, Blair Baker, was really kind. She was in a play with me, like an off-Broadway play. And she sort of taught me how to be a professional actor as an adult. She was like, you know, if you want to be seen, if you want to sort of get your name out there and you are not a Nepo baby, you're the opposite of that, then you need to make your own work and you need to try to meet casting directors. And so I was, for a few years, I was really just working a ton at Buffalo Wild Wings and tutoring and doing a million different jobs in New York so that I could go to casting director workshops and like meet these people and do a scene for them for 5 minutes. And then I was making short films with my friends. And that actually started to get a lot more of my attention because filmmaking and doing something collaboratively is so much more interesting to me than anything else. And so I made a short film and then made a bunch more, and we have a little production company. And so by the time Mutt came around, I had done like a few recurring roles, like small roles on TV, had never been in a feature in a meaningful way, but had done a lot of short films and knew that I could do something. It was just like this feeling of, am I going to wait? Is there a room for me in Hollywood as like a trans masculine non-binary person? What, I don't know. So I'm not going to wait. I'm just going to keep doing what I'm doing. And then I read Mutt, or I saw a post about it on Instagram and saw an email about it on this listserv that I'm on. And I emailed Vuk and I said, you know, you don't know me, but I am this part. Can you, what can I do? Please give it to me. And then I auditioned and I got it. And it was just quite literally the first time I had heard of a feature film where there was a trans masculine lead actor. I just had never even seen that as a potential opportunity besides Boys Don't Cry, you know, 20 years before, 15 years before. So yeah. And then it has changed my little life, which is so sweet. And Mutt is such a small movie. And yet it has had this magical, broader impact than any of us could have imagined. So it's really nice to feel like for the first time in my life, all the things that I've been doing can suddenly be legitimate in a way, you know, like I am a working professional. I'm not just an artist who's keeping their nose to the ground and doing it, but no one knows and no one cares and no one notices, you know, or I can't live off of it or whatever.
Yeah.
We should say, for people who haven't seen it yet, you play Fania in Mutt, and the movie's sort of 24 hours in the life of this character. And it's a pretty action-packed 24 hours because he crosses paths with an ex-boyfriend and a teenage sister that he hasn't seen in a long time and is about to see his dad for the first time in 2 years. And it is such a, it's interesting earlier when you were talking about people thinking you were a Cancer, the like the sensitivity, the sensuality, like that comes through so much in this performance. But I've heard you say in other interviews, that's kind of where you and the character diverge a little bit. So talk about how the ways in which you're not Fenya and how it might've changed once you were cast.
Yeah, I mean, Fenya, as he was written on the page, was a lot pricklier and more defensive as a human than I am. He had a shorter fuse and was kind of like ready to assume that people didn't understand him or don't understand him and don't love him or can't love him in some way. And in that, it was an anti-hero. He wasn't super likable on the page, but you loved it anyways. And when I came, you know, when I was fully signed on to the project and started working with Vuk, we sort of talked about it where it became obvious that the way that this was going to be the most effective, because it was such a, it's such a small grounded movie. I mean, it literally takes place over 24 hours. The invitation is to strip everything you can away and to get as close to capturing what it feels like to be alongside this person over the course of the day as possible. And I think likability is a big part of that. And while it is deeply radical to allow trans people and all people to be unlikable on screen, we don't want to just always be the saints. That being said, like, it is also radical to be likable and to be desirable and to be sensuous as a trans masculine person, especially because I think trans masculinity historically has been asexualized in media. We are totally not sexual beings. We are the nerdy assistant. We are the awkward best friend. We are, it's the same thing, the same arc that I think gay men have gone through, where it was like, oh, you're always sort of the asexual butt of the joke. And then now we can see gorgeous, you know, hot, sexy love affairs happen on screen. You know, passages, all kinds of things that we see. But so when Vuk and I were working on it, we sort of decided that Fenya could be a lot sweeter and softer than he was on the page. And I think the way that I'm different than Fenya is that that is sort of the majority of who I am. I don't have these kind of smaller emotional outbursts that Fenya has. And I also, I don't know, Fenya is a child of abuse. And I'm really lucky that I'm not. And he has to move through the world in a way that I don't have to because of those formative experiences when he was young with his mother. And yeah, I think what's cool is that there were, you know, 70-year-old white women from Illinois leaving the theater and saying, I've never met a trans person, but now I feel like I have a trans friend. I love Fenya. Like, my friends from Northwestern had their grandparents and parents watching this movie, and they had never met a trans person, never felt a connection to the cause, but they meet Fenya, and because he's likable, because he's sensitive, because all of the other characters are written in this way where they have humanity too, and they're not, no one is a villain, it allows so many more people than just the queer community to receive entrance into this film. And in fact, I think it's actually more for the cis community, this particular film, than it is for the queer community, who maybe is a little bit more woke on a lot of the stuff that's being talked about in this. But yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, a relationship that I don't think I've seen depicted is the relationship between Fenya and John. This is his ex. And, you know, that when the movie starts, they're in a bar, they're running into each other for the first time in like a year and a half. And you get right away that John is still very wounded by what happened and angry and hasn't seen Fenya since he transitioned. And, but that there's also that still an undeniable attraction between them. And this, of course, confuses John because he identifies as a straight guy. I don't want to spoil what happens between the two of them, but how did that relationship resonate for you?
Well, it's funny because I talk about this with my trans masculine friends. There's these phases, it seems, in trans masculinity where, at least for me, for a long time, this is maybe answering a little more than you asked, but it's relevant. So for a long time, I was performing femininity, an idea of femininity. It was sitting over there and I was sort of striving to achieve it. And so I felt both alienated from femininity and alienated from masculinity because it was just the other thing that was gazing at my imperfect performance. And then I started to identify as non-binary. I was coming into my queerness. Then I was sort of putting on masculinity in this way. I was wearing it as a coat and I was like, look at me, I'm masculine. And I would date more feminine looking women as a way to affirm my masculinity. So again, femininity was over there. Now it was this object that I was admiring and that was bolstering me up. And then when I got gender affirming care, top surgery, started taking testosterone, really started to present more fully as who I am, I was able to strip all of that away and realize, oh, wow, first, I'm a really girly boy. I'm so much more feminine than I've ever even known and have been discovering my authentic femininity through that. And I hope we're allowed to say this, I'm kind of a fag. Like, I'm just like a faggy boy. I'm like, oh my goodness, like, I love boys in crop tops. Like there is a part of me that is a gay boy. And I think that a lot of trans guys go through this where they first start dressing sort of like a grandpa or like a boy in middle school where they're like really boyish. And then they go into their fag era and they're just in mesh and crop tops and hoop earrings and suddenly wearing these feminine things or positioning their body in a more feminine way that they were never able to do before they were on testosterone or other sort of had access to other gender affirming care. So that is just a gender journey, which is different than sexuality. But what's so beautiful is that one, in the movie, we separate this idea that to be trans masculine, you must be interested in women because you're just a binary man. No, Fenya is a gay trans guy, as Vuk is as well. I'm like a bisexual trans guy. And I'm only able to be that because I'm expressing myself authentically in my gender, I'm able to have authentic desire for men and the male form and masculinity in this way that I've never been able to have. And it's sort of a sexual awakening that I've been inside of for the past 2 years or so. And building this relationship with Cole Doman, who's a queer man, playing a straight man. It was just, the whole thing felt very sort of filled with fuckery. Am I allowed to curse on this? I'm just.
Yes, very much so.
Yes.
It just felt so filled with upside down sort of doing things in the opposite way. And it felt exciting and fun. And shooting Mutt was right before the beginning of my gender or my sexual awakening. Cause my friend had a birthday party that something happened with this guy. And then I went to Zipolite, Mexico, like a few months after finishing Mutt. And I didn't know that it was a gay beach in Mexico, let alone like a queer trans nude haven. And I went and had sort of a sexual awakening in Zipolite also.
Wow.
And so this interaction with Cole and John, the character before that, was kind of like it was like lighting a match almost, or just putting the match close to the box and then it got lit later. But when we were doing that scene, Cole and I was going through all of this stuff in my head of feeling like he can't possibly desire me. I feel so embarrassed that I have to do this scene. And like, I was reckoning with my own feelings about my desirability. And it was through doing that scene with him that I was able to find an authentic way to be embodied and erotic in front of people and with someone who theoretically wouldn't desire me, because Cole is a cis man. So my history with cis men is, oh, they don't desire me if I'm in my transness. Like, I'm losing my vitality as a person in the eyes of cis men. But then he's gay, so it's like double. He's not attracted to me because I'm not a gay man. There's all these insecurities that can emerge, when in actuality Cole and I had beautiful chemistry. And if I could just relax and recognize, like, wow, these are just two human beings who have a physical, indescribable connection that goes beyond the stories that we're putting on each other about who we are or what we're meant to be, Like, that is where the real love, intimacy, and sexual attraction come from. And that was happening for me in real life. And it's also the thing that the film is trying to communicate. And so it's so beautiful that that was the moment in my life when this was happening, was sort of right then. And then it, you know, was able to fully blossom after. But yeah, Vuk, I love Vuk. I like that he did that. I like that it's a gay story instead of a...
I do too. And I'm sure that so much of that inner reckoning that you're talking about served the performance, because, you know, in so many ways, Fenya is probably thinking the same thing as he, you know, reconnects with John. And for them, a big moment, a big spark is when John asks to see Fenya's scars from top surgery, and not in an exploitative way, but in a way that, you know, I'm sure Fenya is thrown by at first. This is on the heels of another conversation where Fenya tells, like, this 22-year-old girl, you know, you don't ask trans people about their genitals. This is a different conversation. And then once he does show John his chest, there, you know, it's on. So how did you feel when you read that in the script and you knew that you would be so exposed?
Oh, it's so beautiful. It's so beautiful on the page. The scene is, it's really, it reads like poetry. I don't know. I think most actors must be masochists, exhibitionists, something, you know. I love to reveal myself. I feel more comfortable in a scene like that than I do recording this podcast. Mm. Literally. Because this podcast is me not performing, being on it myself, what is real, what's not real. That is, there's nothing real or unreal. It's just what is, you know, like I can literally just take this jacket off and allow this person to come close to me and be affected by that. And I don't have to do anything. I can be inside of it. And so I was really grateful to be able to be a part of that scene. And Cole is such a fantastic actor, but he's also a really amazing scene partner. He was so kind and present and gentle. And we were shooting that as our first overnight shoot during production. So there was already this magic, playful feeling on set of everyone gearing up to stay up all night long inside this laundromat together. It felt like a slumber party. And during the moment of shooting that scene, it was so quiet in the room and it felt like we were performing some kind of ritual. And I can only imagine that, you know, 20 years from now, that scene is going to be historic, because I had never seen something like that on screen, and it's 2024. Hello, yeah. You know, yeah. Oh my goodness. And then the amount of people that have reached out to me, hundreds of strangers telling me, wow, I didn't know how to feel watching this movie and this scene of desiring it, but desiring it for myself. It's that thing, that queer thing of, do I want to be them or do I want to have sex with them? Mm. You know, what is this? And activating that eroticism within us that goes beyond just, you know, sexual desire, but is a kind of embodied erotic in the way that bell hooks and Audre Lorde talk about it. It's like, that is cool as hell. Yeah. It's just so cool. And weirdly, this book, not weirdly, but fun. My friend just got me this book. It's called We Both Laughed in Pleasure. And it's the diaries of Lou Sullivan, who was this trans guy roaming around San Francisco in the 90s, mostly, but you know, this diary start in 61. He's a gay trans guy. And he was sort of a pioneer in that space. So it's nice that he's with us right now. How sweet.
Oh, nice. Mm-hmm. So how has the experience of being a part of this movie affected your dating life, love life? Has it?
Well, yes, it has, in a sense. I was shooting Mutt. We shot it in September into October of 2022. And then I went to go live in Mexico with a close friend of mine for 6 weeks in November and December of 2022 as a way to revitalize my spirit as an artist and, you know, deal with the depression of finishing a movie. And I had gone through a breakup and all this stuff. And while I was in Mexico, I was having this love affair with this woman who is now my partner for 6 weeks over text and DM. We were sending each other poetry, and then it was erotic, and it was us getting to know each other because she was in New York and I was in Mexico. And we finally met after the 6 weeks at the end of December of 2022 and had, you know, two very beautiful nights together at the Sunset Tower Hotel in West Hollywood.
Nice.
And it was a vibe. I was like, oh my goodness. And I had just, as I was telling you guys, after Mutt, I went to my friend's birthday party, and it wasn't a sex party, but it was like a sexy party. People had just come from a sex party the night before because my friend's birthday was a 4-day event.
Wow.
I wasn't at the sex party, but I was at the next day. And so everyone was sort of in that space already. And I had this love affair with this guy, Cody, who is just a total, like, I had never been attracted to or sort of viewing myself as connected to someone like Cody. He's so beautiful and gorgeous, but, you know, he's like a cis dude who's a sound engineer for bands. You know, he's Cody the roadie. Like, he's just a normal dude. And I was so attracted to him, and our chemistry was off the chain. And I was like, wait, what? And then when I went to Mexico, I couldn't go home for Christmas, because, which I was supposed to, because my family got COVID. They're okay. And so I was like, I need to take myself to the beach to just comfort myself, to be alone during Christmas. And I was scrolling through Airbnb trying to find the cheapest beachfront property that I could stay at. And I chose this place, and I show up, and it's Zipolite. And I've never heard of Zipolite. I just intuited my way to the queer nude beach of Mexico. And it was crazy. The bed and breakfast, it turned out to be a bed and breakfast. It was called Heaven. And it was clothing optional. And there were all these beautiful gay men around me. And I was like, where am I? What's going on? So I'm in the pool watching the sunset naked. And this guy comes up to me. He's like, Leo, we're having a party tonight. You should come, because it's Christmas Eve. I'm like, oh, that's great. Where is it? He's like, here. And I'm like, okay, great. Perfect. And so then I go and I change and I come back out, and I'm partying with these like 30 or 40 gorgeous gay men from Morocco and Istanbul and Williamsburg and whatever. And I had, you know, I took Viagra for the first time and had a moment. I didn't have sex, but I did take Viagra, and it was a vibe. It was really fun. And sort of since then, my partner and I are non-monogamous, and have been since we've started dating. And so I've been able to both build a deep love with her and also explore my sexuality and explore what it feels like to consider myself desirable, because quite literally, this is the first time in my life that I have felt that way. And I think a lot of trans people, it's like you go through the portal of transness. Okay, here I am. This is how I identify. This is who I am. But then there's this other portal of desirability that you have to go through, where you believe yourself to be sexy, to be able to be embodied enough that you are not on the trans feminine side of things just objectified as a sexual object, or on the trans masculine side of things asexualized and desexualized, like to just be actually vital, sexual, gorgeous, desirable, sexy, and comfortable being naked or whatever else. So I've been able to have that journey with her, which is really cool. And it doesn't hurt that, like, now I'm doing cool photo shoots where I look hot. And so now people are sliding into my DMs trying to hang out. Yeah. Like, that's not bad. It's a fun time.
Well, this is a journey we're going to be checking in on, let's say once a quarter going forward.
Because I give you the real tea on air.
Yeah.
We need it.
You're in the family now. You're in the family now, whether you like it or not.
I love it.
Leo, thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you.
What a pleasure. Mutt is streaming on Netflix. Everybody go give it a watch. And yeah, Leo, please come back anytime. I got to say, when you were talking about entering this second portal, some kind of shimmer happened in the mirror right behind you, or the perfect moment. It was, I don't know, something's going on there.
I love it. The cosmos are with us.
Yes.
Thank you guys so much. This is so
Thank you.
That is our show. Please do give us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts and follow us on Instagram at HomophiliaPod. Homophilia is a World of Wonder production, music by Ben Wise. Our executive producer is Renee Colvert. Our associate producer is Jess Walensky, and our audio engineer is Justin Mattson. Many thanks to Michael Pressman and everyone at World of Wonder.